local teachers quit the classroom, even file wills and obits before school starts. A local sheriff faces felony charges and turns himself in. And the city of Jax is expanding its Cure Violence program. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, how you can enjoy the sweetness of this area's Honeybee Festival set for this weekend virtually. We'll tell you about it. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss yet another busy week in the news, we welcome David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
Writer Claire Goforth back with us. Hi, Claire.
Hi, good morning.
Void Live contributor Shelton Hall. Good morning, Shelton.
Good morning.
And Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal. Hey, Tim.
How are you doing?
Good to have all four of you on the show once again. Lots to get into this week. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic across the state by the numbers. Statewide, we are at 557,137 cases of COVID. The death toll stands in the state at 8,913, with 345 deaths in our area. Now we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at how the pandemic is affecting back to school. The toll of this crisis has the state's teachers quitting the classroom altogether, or sometimes making public their wills and obits in advance. Yeah, 33-year-old Whitney Reddick is a special ed teacher in Jacksonville. She is going back into the classroom next week. But here's what she did. She posted her own obituary on Facebook recently. It has since gone viral. She said things like, Whitney left us while alone in isolation and on a ventilator at a Duval County hospital. And even though she shouted from the rooftops, she succumbed to the ignorance of those in power and returned to work. A cri de coeur by the state's teachers is how we begin the hour. Let us know how you feel about teachers going back into the classroom and how they are even posting their obits on social media as a way to protest this state of affairs. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax or weigh in on Facebook. David Bauerlein, this obit that your paper wrote about in the Times Union has now been featured on the Today Show, People Magazine. The teacher, Whitney Reddick, says she's trying to encourage Duval County Public Schools to pivot to 100% distance learning until the red zone that we are in for positive cases goes down. The superintendent, Diana Green, is like other superintendents around the state. She is under the orders of a state mandate to present a plan they will approve that includes some brick and mortar classes. So what's been the reaction at the paper where you are after you wrote about Whitney Reddick's obituary? What are readers saying to you about that?
Well, I mean, I think it does strike a chord without a doubt, because there is this vast apprehension about what the situation is going to be like when people actually do get into the school, the classrooms. So, yes, there's a huge amount of anxiety. Now, the same teacher who did get so much attention for posting that virtual obituary is also going to be returning to the classroom. And so that, in a nutshell, kind of captures the dichotomy people feel, which is this great anxiety, and at the same time, this real understanding that what they do is of value, and there's a real value to having children back in brick and mortar schools, resuming their education and their socialization and all those other good things that happen in the classroom.
It's 549-2937 to join us. Here is a statement from Superintendent Diana Green. She said, Claire, that teaching is a public service, but it's unlikely any of us thought about a long-term global pandemic when we chose this path to serve children. She says we must move forward with precautions to support employees and serve those students who need us in classrooms. A poll published by NPR says 82% of teachers in this country fear returning to the classroom. One in five say they are unlikely to go back. They're just going to quit. What are your thoughts about this? And also Governor Ron DeSantis this week saying that the back to school effort in Florida is like the effort to kill Osama bin Laden. He made that comparison.
Yeah, that was not really a fitting comparison, I would say. He tried to clarify it later, but with limited success. I mean, what I'm seeing with the school issue in the midst of this pandemic is that our leaders have essentially made a calculation that it's more important to have children in school than it is to keep the pandemic from spreading and to keep the number of deaths and serious illnesses down. That does seem to be how they've measured it, that kids need to be back in school, because we know for a fact that we're going to see outbreaks. I mean, look at what's happened in Georgia already. The same school with the viral picture of students crowded in hallways without masks or social distancing later had to quarantine, what is it, 900 people. We're going to see that here, and we're going to see families get sick, and that's just reality. And I do not envy the role of Superintendent Green or anyone else involved in this decision, parents included. It is so emotional and so difficult that, you know, we're all kind of flying blindly and hoping for the best, but knowing that we're going to see some tragedies in reality.
It's 549-2937. We'll go to your calls in a moment. Tim Gibbons, you know, let's just say for the sake of argument, the school year begins under this hybrid learning model. Kids go to class in staggered groups. Cases spike. People get sick. There are some deaths. Everything shuts down again in a month or two. What about the argument that this could have been avoided if the state had not forced this model on districts?
And that's the great fear, that it's not like this is a decision that can be made. We go back to school and that's it. Everything's fine. Once cases start spreading, the likelihood that everything goes virtual again anyhow is fairly high, just in a way more convoluted sort of way of doing it. You know, we talk to a lot of businesses, and exactly what you just described, Melissa, is what they're seeing, that everything shut down. It was a hard time. They got through it. And then by just throwing off all caution and just, you know, getting back to what it used to be like, all of that time and hard work was wasted because, yeah, you know, we're back to where we started. We actually could have just done this months ago. And I think that these schools are possibly setting themselves up for the same sort of scenario.
Yeah. Shelton Hull, going beyond schools, there just is this overall weariness with the pandemic that I think is leading to some poor decisions by a lot of people. As just one example, earlier this week, a colleague and I went somewhere to get lunch with the intention of sitting outside while we ate lunch, since that's just a safer thing to do. But when we went into this place to get our food, there was no social distancing. It was absolutely packed, no masks anywhere to be seen, despite a citywide mask order. There were a couple of servers wearing masks, but not all of them. And, you know, I think that we're seeing this kind of relaxing of the vigilance across this community. And it will lead to more cases of COVID, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. You know, they always say it's bad form to mock the dead. And I think even more so to mock the dead before they're even dead yet. That's what's happening in the schools. That's what's happening all over the state right now. We could have contained this situation months ago. Had we had mandatory mask wearing, had we had mandatory social distancing, there are thousands of people dead now who would still be alive had we done things correctly. And over the course of this process, you know, it comes down to bad leadership from Tallahassee, bad leadership from Washington. They've known what could be done right. They've seen what's worked in other countries. New Zealand, you know, is down to practically nothing. Many other countries. Not only have we, you know, engaged in poor decision making, but we've openly mocked people who are crying, begging, pleading, writing their wills, saying there are people that first responders that don't get to see their families now because of all this. And, you know, you look at what's happening with the teachers in our community. For years now, we talk about this every week. They are laughed at. They are ridiculed. They are disrespected. You know, their pay is not what it should be. They're class sizes are too big. They've had to live under the threat of being shot in their classrooms for years now, and now they're being forced to go out there and deal with the pandemic that they were just thrown out into with no preparation. If kids get sick in the schools, no one's going to tell them. As the numbers go up, we're going to bury the numbers like we've been burying the numbers.
Let me jump in on that. Teachers have expressed worries that they won't be told if they have a colleague who's positive in their school, or if a number of students are positive. Then we're hearing that from multiple school districts. There's this widespread cynicism that they won't get accurate information.
They will not be told. They might not be told if they test positive themselves. Who knows what's going on with these testing companies? You know, I've seen people going out getting tests. It's taken them 2 weeks, 3 weeks to get tested. If they were serious about this, they would have tested. I would have all the students tested and all the teachers tested, you know, 2 weeks before the school system begins, before the school year begins, because as it is now, one person introduced into this environment, as we saw in Georgia, one person introduced in this environment, it'll spread faster than anyone knows what to do with. And then once the genie's out of the bottle, there's no putting it back in.
Let's go to some calls now. It's our Friday Media Roundtable with Shelton Hall, Tim Gibbons, Claire Goforth, David Bauerline, yours truly. And we're beginning with a look at teachers actually publishing their obits on social media in advance as they go back into the classroom next week in Duval County. What are your thoughts about the situation for teachers and also people in other essential occupations who are at risk? 549-2937 to join us. Richard on the north side. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Thank you all for covering this.
Sure.
I really appreciate it. Well, my thoughts as it relates, I mean, I would love to be there and be a part of this conversation. It's really great, but I'll just focus on one particular area. It seems like what's not discussed is how easy this pandemic in Jacksonville specifically has been able to be split right wing, left wing, conservative, Democrat. I guarantee you that you were not on the north side. You were not in an area that was maybe Democratic. You were not in a place, that restaurant you went to was probably not multiracial. It was, you know, everybody that's in there without masks or those that are openly defying government. And that's because of the rhetoric that's coming from a Republican president down through a Republican governor to a Republican mayor. And if it wasn't for pushback from the city, we'd be talking about the Republican National Convention here. That one, I don't know how many teachers have written their obituaries, but I guarantee you there have been black teachers every day going in death sentences, basically, and loving our kids enough to teach them and never once thought about writing an obituary. But this teacher, and the only thing about her obituary that bothered me was like the ignorance in high places or something, and that felt like it was targeted directly at the superintendent. And it bothers me that...
Really? Maybe she was criticizing the governor, the Department of Education. I don't know.
Right. If you wrote a letter and said, I'm tired of going to work where there's ignorance in high places, it would sort of be difficult that your boss would not see that as directed to him, or maybe easy if he had a boss above him that he could blame. But really, that goes to my point. Everybody is able to say things, hurl dynamite and grenades, and nobody takes the personal responsibility because it's always somebody else's fault. And I just would love to see us get to the point to where we do the things that we need to do as individuals, wash our hands, wear a mask, social distance.
Yeah. And Richard, you're absolutely right. And let me clarify, if I could, that Mayor Curry, who is a Republican, as you pointed out, has been quite proactive about mask wearing and issuing a citywide mask order. I just wanted to make sure people understood that part of this. But I want to thank you for your call. David Bauerline, unfortunately, this pandemic has become politicized. And where you stand on wearing a mask, how you feel about the canceling of college sports, how you feel about back-to-school planning is sometimes a reflection of your politics, which is so unfortunate because public health should not be political. Science is science. And we know what the science says and what we need to do to save lives, right?
Right. You see that in all the polling, that there is a difference in terms of political affiliation, in terms of how people feel like the public health response should be, how one person views the mask as good public health precaution, another is kind of the oppressive hand of government. So there's definitely a split there. And it has been shown some political divides. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. And here are a few emails coming into the show about this. Claire, an email from Andrew. It's as if the schoolhouse is on fire and teachers are being told to keep teaching and ignore the smoke and flames. No one is served if the school environment is not safe. Your thoughts?
I mean, has Andrew thought about a career in writing? Because that was an excellent way of putting it. I mean, you know, to his point and to David's and the previous caller's point, it's like we're living in two worlds right now. One world has pandemic fatigue, and they're just getting on with it as if it's not even happening. And the other is still social distancing, still staying home, still wearing masks and taking every precaution that they can. And it's so disappointing to see it be so politicized. It's as if Americans have forgotten to care for their fellow man, some of them. And we're going to see this play out in the school system very tragically in coming months. I mean, there's just no way around it.
Tim Gibbons, what about the point of view of, say, a restaurant owner or a business owner who's trying to navigate this? Their customers are, as Claire said, a lot of them sick of these restrictions. They have suffered financially. They are being allowed to reopen with restrictions, but they're not always following the restrictions, as I mentioned. And there's not real right. enforcement of the restrictions either.
And the idea that that enforcement is supposed to be on the, you know, retail clerk managing a register who is probably concerned about their own safety and has, frankly, enough stuff going on that now they have to fight with someone who thinks not wearing a mask is a badge of freedom. It's a really hard position for businesses to be in. You know, we've talked to business owners who would be perfectly happy being tougher, but you know, they don't have the infrastructure and arguably should not have the infrastructure to set up to enforce this. You know, it's one thing to tell someone walking into a store, hey, you know, pointing at the no shoes, no shirt sign. That's not been politicized. Not wearing a shirt into a store is not an act of political courage, but somehow not wearing a mask has become that. What I find fascinating, though, is that if you look at surveys, we had one this morning from USF that 82% of people in Florida think that social distancing and masks work. Something like 73% saying they would strongly support a statewide mask mandate. The people that you're seeing out in the street who are making this a thing, who are not wearing masks, those are the outliers. But if they're the people who are out, they're the more visible ones. People who are, you know, feel safer staying home and venturing out, you know, not as often and wearing a mask when they go out, they're going to be less of the population you see. So you're seeing the people who, frankly, are not the bulk of the state, but they are the people whose state leaders are listening to.
Lots of tweets. Here's one. The superintendent is on record saying only if schools close will people be informed of who's positive. How is this acceptable? Let's go to Robert in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Robert. Good morning.
Good morning. I volunteer with Florida Youth Maritime Training, and we've been providing free vocational training to disadvantaged youth at risk for the past 4 months. We disinfect our classroom ourselves every day. I respect the concept of a teacher saying, I'm afraid to go to work, but I think if the teacher chooses to say that, the teacher should be off the payroll.
Thanks. Thank you, Robert. Here's another email from a listener. If teachers aren't allowed to strike, but they called in sick, I'm sure the medical community would provide them doctor's notes. They should do an informal, unorganized sick out. Shelton Hall, for people that aren't aware of the law, it is illegal for teachers in the state of Florida to go on strike. That's what she's referring to.
Yeah, and it makes sense now when we see this. If teachers were allowed to strike, they would be striking right now. It's a terrible situation. You know, I've got 5 nieces and nephews from age 13 down to about 3. I've got 2 sisters who are teachers. I've got a 68-year-old mom who's a counselor in schools, you know, and I'm not going to get to hug them for gosh knows how long. I've hugged my mom maybe 3 times all year because the governor doesn't know how to do his job, because the president doesn't know how to do his job. You know, and I've got all these friends that are teachers that are calling me on the phone in tears because they don't know what's going to happen. We've got parents who, you know, I know people who are parents who have quit their jobs so they can homeschool their kids because they're afraid to send their kids into school. Now, and you multiply this by thousands and thousands of people. And then it also raises the question, you know, whether it's our grades, whether it's our test scores, will any of the results from this school year even be legitimate? You've got these traumatized kids, these frightened kids out here in these terrible circumstances being taught by teachers that are frightened and terrified and traumatized. And then, you know, watch the test scores go low and watch the politicians blame the kids, blame the parents, blame the teachers as if it's their fault. It's beyond tragic. It's morally repugnant because it doesn't have to be this way. They can open these schools back up and do it in a way that is physically, that is safe for their bodies and safe for the spirits and the minds of these children and these teachers, but they're not doing it. They're mocking them. They're laughing at them.
David Bauerlein, some districts in Florida have essentially not defied the state, but presented plans to the state that have been approved that do allow them to go all virtual. That is not the case in our part of the state. And that is being driven by the percentage of positive cases. Now, that said, Duval County is in what is called the red zone, and opening school even under a hybrid model flies in the face of guidelines from the CDC and public health officials. I just want to make sure people understand that that's where we are in North Florida. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Right. Well, obviously, there is a choice for families and students as far as whether they're going to go to the brick and mortar school or do the virtual distance learning. So that is an option they have. Then you get to the situation of people who are actually the teachers. I think there's some choice if you have an underlying condition, but obviously, if you don't, then your choice is between either working or not working. And that's a really stark choice for people to make. The percent positives are lower here than in some other parts of the state, like South Florida. They have been overall trending downward, so there's been some positive direction there. But it is still the percent positive is higher now than it was a couple of months ago. So it's still relatively, it hasn't gotten better since. It's not better now than it was when the school year ended, I guess is the point in terms of what the pandemic's like out there in the community. And the community is the schools, and the schools are the community. There's no barrier wall you can put up there.
That's right.
You know, it is a very difficult situation. Now, you know, are teachers who are who don't want to go back to school, are they also not going to Publix, to Home Depot? Are they doing everything virtually? Are they not leaving their homes for anything? I mean, there are certain risks, if you want to put it that way, that everybody's taking in their daily lives to go out and be part of the greater society. And, you know, that there are some concerns, obviously, in a school that you have a much larger concentration of people there.
And you're there for a longer time. Yeah, you're there all day.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a different animal in that sense from, say, going into a Home Depot. But, you know, if you're a worker at Home Depot, you're not there for 30 minutes. You're there for an 8-hour shift.
That's right.
It's the same thing that a lot of workers are facing throughout the community in terms of the choices they're making every day.
That's right. And if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We're going to move on now and talk about another big headline from the week. Clay County Sheriff Daryl Daniels. Did you see that last night he turned himself into authorities? This after Daniels was given an ultimatum by a special prosecutor to either resign or be arrested. The sheriff is up for re-election, and he faces 4 charges, 4 felony counts having to do with a sex scandal he's involved with in Clay County. Here is Sheriff Daniels.
One thing that's very suspicious to me is the fact that within days of a primary election, the powers that be, specifically the state attorney's office, has decided that today is the day that they will execute their plan and interfere with what's going on with the sheriff, with me.
We want to hear from you, especially if you're in Clay County. Give us a call at 549-2937. Claire Goforth, Daniel's attorney, says his client will not resign and still plans to stand for re-election next week. He has been under scrutiny by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement for over a year. He's been accused of ordering one of his deputies to illegally arrest his former girlfriend for stalking last year. As I said, he faces four felony counts and a misdemeanor count in this ongoing scandal that may or may not oust him from office. He's standing for office despite all this. What are your thoughts about
this?
It may
be interesting to see a sheriff who is going to trial, who's being tried for felonies. You know, you really have to admire his moxie on one hand, because to say all of this when everything has been so far, like, well reported in the press, there's no doubt about a lot of the things that have happened. I mean, there's just so much evidence. And for him to say that this is somehow politically motivated, I mean, yes, the timing is a little, I think they just don't want to see this guy win his primary potentially, or the investigation had concluded. It would be very interesting to see whether he manages to win that primary.
Yeah.
I mean, he certainly has delivered the red meat to the Clay County voters with some of those interesting ads he had earlier this year. And maybe that will be enough to overcome their qualms about voting for somebody who's, you know, been charged with four felonies.
That's right.
I mean, it's obviously a new slogan of knows the justice system inside and out. I mean,
yeah. I mean, Tim, he was facing a six-way primary, and he was favored actually to win. Whether this changes things, we don't know.
I mean, that's going to be the interesting question of how do voters process this information. You know, anyone's guess.
Right. I mean, this is coming as voting is underway, Shelton, and the primary is Tuesday. He has a lot of name recognition, and despite his scandals,
yes,
he has a lot of fans in Clay County.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, anytime you see a black guy in a cowboy hat, it's just a matter of time before something happens. And I'm glad he's not resigning. I'm glad he's standing for re-election, because he's a bad person and he deserves to be publicly ridiculed. You know, he slut-shamed this woman he was having an affair with. He abused police resources. He threatened to call out, like, armed cops on peaceful protesters. He had a guy arrested for standing, like, out in the median with the sign. You know, they're trying to give him a chance for an easy out. They're trying to give him a golden parachute. And he's just here humiliating himself over and over again, making a mockery of Clay County. Like, Clay County doesn't have enough to be, you know, embarrassed about this year. It's a terrible year for black.
What else should they be embarrassed? What else?
Sheriffs.
What are you saying? What else should they be embarrassed about
around the country now?
OK, let's go to some calls.
Well, they voted for him.
I see. Okay. 549-2937. Hector in San Marco. Hi, Hector. Good morning.
Yes. I would, like I'm saying, this man is a crook. He had an affair with another man's wife. He also withheld evidence from the state of Florida. He is not an example of what law enforcement is all about. He is a criminal, and the people of Clay County will be very good for them if this individual was to go to jail. He makes all law enforcement look bad. And he is not an example of what law enforcement is in the United States of America. I promise you, he is not that. So we should be ashamed. He needs to go to jail with the criminals that he falsely accused of crimes they probably did not commit. So please, please, people of Clay County, encourage your law enforcement to put this person where he belongs, in the jail behind bars, for at least whatever the legislative law dictates.
Thanks,
Thank
Hector.
You.
Thanks, Hector. Tom on the West Side. Hello, Tom.
Good morning. I just wanted to say that I think that the timing can probably be best explained by considering that if he was removed from office after the election, then that would put one of his co-conspirators in his position. And obviously, that's not a result we want. And as for the length of this investigation, well, his co-conspirators and he did everything they could to obstruct the investigation. So he really has no place complaining about the length of it.
Here is, thank you, a tweet from Sierra. The Clay sheriff trying to play off the proximity of his arrest to Election Day is a joke. She says it speaks only to the proximity of his illegal behavior right before a re-election year. The investigation was an appropriate length. David Bauerlein, Daniels has been under investigation by FDLE for over a year, and he did turn himself into authorities, we do need to note, last night. So that we just want to make sure people are caught up on the timeline of this.
Yeah, I'd find one part of many. It's a whole crazy, bizarre story, everything about it. But I find it kind of bizarre that this is all happening midway through early voting. And so what if he had resigned? Then all these people who had voted for him basically cast a useless ballot. They don't get to go back and re-vote for one of the other five. And then, it's just a weird, weird way to come in at this point and have this dropped in the middle of the race. Now, are people who voted for him regret their vote now and say, oh, I wouldn't have voted for him if I'd known this? Well, I think this has been baked in the cake in terms of a lot of the people who maybe are early voters. Now, maybe, though, there's some people who in those final days have been kind of going back and forth, and now they've got an actual mugshot of the chief law enforcement of the county booked on felony charges, and they're going to say, okay, I'm going to look at the other five and make a choice there because, you know, there seems to be a really substantial case. That could tip the election. But, you know, there you have so many people voting, so many people running that you don't need to get a majority to win this primary.
That's right. I want to correct an error I made a minute ago. Daniels faces three felony charges, one misdemeanor count. Okay. Let's take another call on this, and then we'll move on. Omar is downtown. Hi, Omar. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. So my comment about Sheriff Daniels, and hey, show. I think it's interesting in two ways. I heard a previous caller say that I think the narrative right now with our country, because of the social injustices and how we're kind of acting, I've seen a lot of people defend him, mainly white people, because he's black. It's like, no, don't crucify him. Don't make him out to be this evil person. Everyone has issues. You know, this is his personal business. I remember, and I'm sure all of us do, when he made national news with that commercial about arming his citizens against protesters and then essentially inviting them in to make the news. So to me, when you pander to white suburban people, which, I mean, let's be honest, it's Clay County. It's pickup trucks. It's subdivision. It is not his base. So when you do that, and when something happens and it comes to you, you can't stand there and act as if, you know, I'm so holy and mighty and, you know, how dare you do this? I'm your sheriff. I try to protect you. No, you went with the wrong decision. And at the end of the day, you are still a black man in a cowboy hat or not. That doesn't change who you are and how people may feel about you. So, I mean, maybe it's karma, but, I mean, you know, you get what you get. So at the end of the day, his own officers arrested him in his own county for what he's, you know, for what he's been charged for. So to me, it sounds like it's just the inevitable.
Okay, Omar. Thank you. By the way, Shelton, a minute ago, you made a comment about a black guy with a cowboy hat. A couple of people or one person on our Facebook page felt that was a racist comment. I know you meant that in jest, but if you could respond
I'm
to that, and then we'll
I
move
have
on.
A cowboy hat, so I know of which I speak.
And Shelton is a jokester, as we all know. And so I wanted to make sure people understood he was applying his satirical lens to the news of the week. Okay, let's talk about a few other items that made news this week. It's 549-2937. New memos emerged this week that seem to show JEA tried to get rid of its nuclear reactor agreement in Georgia as part of its overall push to privatize the utility. Now, this is a bit of a complicated story. Tim Gibbons, this ran in the TU this week. Let me clarify, you're with the Business Journal, but I know you've been following this. What do you make of these memos? Go ahead, Tim.
Oh, so it's just another
step in the entire mess that is JEA. There's been a couple interesting things. There's the need for all of the bidders to reveal how much they're willing to pay, and then there's the information that Nate Monroe had involving the mayor's push to do the sale. So it's interesting because I think in some ways the pandemic almost made people not forget JEA, but it definitely moved it to the back burner. But those investigations are still ongoing and media are still looking at them, and there is still plenty of interest and developments happening there.
Claire, go forth. Full disclosure, your husband's a JEA employee. But in this memo, and I'm quoting here from the TU, a lawyer for Holland and Knight says Jacksonville's new young Republican mayor is out to shrink government and wants to privatize JEA quickly while the market is right. He says within 3 to 5 months. This confirms what we've really honestly known for some time, which is that Mayor Curry was privately pushing privatization of JEA.
Melissa, I think Claire's having some technical issues.
Okay, let's go to David Bauerlein. David, this is in the Times Union. If you could, shed a little more light on what you've learned and your colleagues about these new memos.
Right. Well, as Tim said, it does add some more understanding that as far back as early 2018, JEA was looking at trying to get out of a really controversial purchase power agreement to get power from the Plant Vogtle nuclear reactors because, among other things, they wanted to clear the decks for a sale of the utility. So it shows how long that has been something that was even predating Aaron Zahn's arrival as the CEO of JEA.
And I think
and the other thing you mentioned as far as the reference to Mayor Curry, which is, it doesn't really attribute how this attorney in Atlanta got that information, but it indicates that, according to this attorney, the mayor was also interested in privatizing, moving quickly, getting it done within months, which was back in 2018 as well. So we know Curry has been supportive of the idea of exploring privatization. This memo says, well, he really wanted to do it. That was his goal as far back as early 2018.
Right. And Shelton, the other thing about this that I think is unsettling to all the ratepayers out there is that JEA was trying to get out of its agreement to help build these nuclear reactors in Georgia, which they are still now stuck with, by the way. And they were going to, it appears, pass the costs off onto the shed themselves of this expensive problem, but eventually pass the costs off onto all of us.
That's generally how it goes. You know, the costs and expenses of these types of deals get borne by the taxpayers, by the ratepayers, and the profits are sort of dished out to private industry. It's a little disturbing seeing how much time we spent talking about how our leaders can't even get people to wear masks in public and can't even get these schools back open safely to think that they have access to nuclear power. I'm deeply concerned. Maybe they should sell it. I mean, can we even trust our leaders to do the right thing with these types of assets? Can we, if we were to sell JEA, as we've discussed in the past, can we even effectively put a value on it? Can we get a good deal on it? How do we know that we can even move any of this stuff out without getting less than it's worth in exchange for some amorphous kickback down the road? You know, with I like the mayor; he's a nice guy and all that. He's the man on a gas grill, but we cannot really trust these people to make the right decisions consistently with public assets. They've exposed themselves too many times.
I think that the incredible pushback to selling JEA shows that the public rose up in such opposition, Tim, that the lack of trust, the lack of transparency means the end result is the privatization push failed. And, you know, unfortunately for JEA, they are still stuck with this agreement, which is very expensive and onerous and not good for them or anybody paying a JEA bill.
Right. And I think that's in some ways, the tragedy of the entire JEA thing was all of this heat and all of this activity, everything that went on to kind of be back to what we were before the Zahn era, before all of this happened. despite spending millions of dollars on the entire process. There are those who say that the Vogtle plant is not as bad of a thing for rate payers as it has been played out to be. We've talked to plenty of people who say that it will have a substantial impact, but obviously that's something that is waiting to be seen. I think it's important to note, though, that we found this in our reporting several months ago, that if JEA had been sold, the planned Vogtle obligations would have stayed with taxpayers. So the argument that Vogtle is going to be expensive and is there for a reason to sell JEA wouldn't have helped ratepayers anyhow. Basically, we're stuck in this situation. You can argue about whether or not getting into the deal was a good one, but we're in it now. And all of the rigmarole around trying to get out of it, really was just a backdoor way of trying to affect the sale.
Okay. Three other news and notes from the week. The mayor said this week the city is expanding its Cure Violence program to a third neighborhood as an attempt to bring down the city's high crime rate. Jacksonville-based Steinmart filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They are closing all of their stores. So get ready for the big going out of business sales at Steinmart's across the area. And last but not least, this week, the city of Jacksonville renamed downtown Hemming Park after the most accomplished person the city has ever produced, James Weldon Johnson. After much back and forth and controversy, it is now James Weldon Johnson Park. David Bauerlein and Shelton Hull, what are you thinking about the resolution of the renaming of the park?
Yeah, it sounds pretty. James Weldon Johnson sounds like a park. Sounds like a good name for a park. I think it's really ingrained itself in the community. It was one of those situations where it was a 16-2 vote, so it was pretty overwhelming by the city council in support of it. And I'm interested in seeing now how they're going to celebrate it. I think we can almost guarantee that there's going to be a nice choir singing Lift Every Voice and Sing at James Weldon Johnson Park with a lot of city council members and mayors and dignitaries there. It'll be a good moment.
Yeah. That song, which Johnson wrote with his brother, is also, by the way, now going to be played at every NFL game, although maybe not this year, Shelton, if we don't know if we're going to have a real season. So at some point it'll be played.
Well, I mean, do we ever have a real season here? but, we criticize our leaders and our politicians. It's been that kind of year. This thing with the renaming of the parks is a nice example of the process actually working well. You got bipartisan support for this. And there's a little negotiation, a little tugging back and forth. Councilman Dennis has had famously bad relations with City Hall. So there is often a perception that nothing would ever pass with him sponsoring the bill. So it's good to see him getting the victory. It's good to see the Republicans finding a way to compromise.
Yes. And thank you all so much for rolling with our technical interesting times as we connected all of you via Google Hangout today. We did lose Claire Goforth. We'll try to get her back next time. Thank you to Claire, David Bauerlein, Shelton Hull, and Tim Gibbons for appearing from a distance on this show. Guys, have a great weekend. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Up next, celebrating Honeybee Day in Jacksonville virtually. We'll tell you how. Don't go away.
And Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering picnic meals in a safe, dog-friendly farm setting where social distancing is top priority. Visit congaryandpenn.com for more information.
The Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Is your business suffering because of coronavirus? Your insurance policy may already provide coverage. Not sure how to tell? Learn more at terrellhogan.com.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
The coronavirus pandemic has sent the markets crashing and soaring, and it's created new opportunities for illegal insider trading. But NPR has found the Trump administration brought the fewest charges for insider trading in decades.
That means they're not trying. That means they told the cops to go play canasta instead of do their job.
An NPR investigation this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
The gloves come off.
This is what happens when we elect a guy who just isn't up for the job.
Joe Biden's new running mate Kamala Harris breaks new ground and paints a new picture for the country. The president says it's a future you don't want to see. I'm Jen White. There's a lot to catch up on in the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, National Honeybee Day is tomorrow. However, the local sponsor of the event, Bee Friends Farm, can't hold their usual festival to celebrate the occasion due to the pandemic. So they're going to move it online. Now, in a moment, we will speak with Bentley Stead with Bee Friends Farm. Do we have Bentley? Bentley, are you there?
Hi, Melissa. This is Brentley.
Good morning. So Bee Friends Farm, Jacksonville Beekeepers, you celebrate National Honeybee Day every year with your amazing Honeybee Festival. It is one of the best festivals of the year. Unfortunately, though, we're in the middle of a pandemic, so you have to move this all online. How is this going to work this weekend?
So we're taking everything that everyone loves about the Honeybee Festival, which is our virtual busy or our busy bee marketplace where we have local vendors. We're going to do our education annex, and we're just going to move it all online. So you can still shop with local vendors. You can still attend free education sessions. We're going to have raffles, and we're going to do some cool bundles for that day, local honey bundles for sale.
That's so great. And for anyone who's ever been to the Honeybee Festival at the fairgrounds, not only is the merch just amazing, you can buy some great honey, but a lot of other great stuff. You learn a lot about the importance of bees. And
absolutely.
In fact, that bees are being threatened too, which is another issue that I know you want to discuss.
Yeah, absolutely. So education is a huge component for us. And we do our kids education area, which we're doing a kids session as well, because we feel like if we can start young and teach them how they can help pollinators, not just honeybees, but all pollinators. And one of our education sessions is about native plants and pollinators. So if people are interested in being a beekeeper, you can learn about that. But if you're also like, I don't have time to manage a hive or I don't have the space for it, you can just learn about a couple ways that you can plant some pollinator plants and help those bees that are endangered.
Yeah. And we don't know fully why bees are dying, why bee colonies are dying. There are some theories, though, correct?
Yes, absolutely. So we have some thoughts, but I think it's the compounding factors. Every time you have something that threatens a hive, it makes it a little bit weaker, just like a human's immune system.
Bees are so important. And this is, as I said, such a fun annual event. Tell me a little bit more, too, about Bee Friends Farm, because people have seen your product in local stores. You really have produced some of the best honey around, I have to say.
Thank you. We like to think so, too, but that's mostly because of our bees.
They're doing all the work.
Yes. Well, our beekeepers work very hard, too. And I like to say, so Michael, who is our beekeeper, he's the one who founded Bee Friends Farm. And he is such a good beekeeper. He cares so much about the health of our hives and the health of our bees. And that just is what makes great honey. So when people are purchasing honey from Bee Friends Farm, they can know that the bees are taken good care of and they're getting the best quality honey they can.
Yeah, and many different varietals, too. Honey is almost like wine, isn't it? There's Yes. There are lots of different bouquets and strains and tastes.
Yes. And so we specialize in the Florida varietals. And so you can get orange blossom honey from us, our Jacksonville wildflower, which we're very proud of, delicious wildflower honey, black mangrove honey, saw palmetto honey, gallberry honey. Those are all like local, real Florida honeys that you can purchase from us. That they're monoflorals, meaning that they come from one specific plant. And a lot of beekeepers will just kind of blend all their honeys together so you get a really nice honey, but we choose to kind of pick out those different floral notes and from those plants specifically. So you're getting some really cool varietal Florida honey.
So you can access all of this, everybody, tomorrow at the virtual Bee Friends Farm Honey Bee Festival as they celebrate National Honey Bee Day tomorrow with an incredible virtual event. It's free. You can find it on Facebook or through their website, beefriendsfarm.com, right?
There's a tab that says Honey Bee Fest on our website. And if you click on it, there's a link to each one of the sections of the festival. So we make it really easy for you to shop with local vendors, visit the virtual education sessions that are happening on Facebook. So we're excited. We'll see you guys tomorrow.
Yeah, check it out tomorrow. And let's hope that next August, the Honey Bee Festival is back at the fairgrounds. Thank you so much, Brentley. Brentley Stead of Bee Friends Farm. Have a great time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield runs digital. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and make sure to tune in to 89.9 today at noon for the Florida Roundup, our statewide live call-in program discussing the biggest stories of the week. Today at noon, two Floridas, to mask or not to mask, sports or no sports, virtual school or brick and mortar school. We'll take a look at a fractured state in this time of coronavirus. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for being with us. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.